This is the Paranormal Podcast with Jim Harold.
Welcome to the Paranormal Podcast. I'm Jim Harold. So glad to be with you once again. So to newcomers, I hope you enjoy the show. Tonight, we're going to talk about the topic of ancient mysteries. So I hope you're up for that. And I hope that you enjoy our show. I'm very honored to have our guest today. Had an opportunity to meet him in person at the Paradigm Symposium I was at a few weeks ago. And we have him today. We're going to talk about ancient civilization. Specifically, we're going to talk about his latest book, Forgotten Civilization, The Role of Solar Outbursts in Our Past and Future. And our guest is the extremely erudite and well-known Robert M. Schock, PhD. He is a tenured faculty member at Boston University. He earned his doctorate in geology and geophysics at Yale University in 1983. His books include Pyramid Quest, Voyages of the Pyramid Builders, Voices of the Rocks, Stratigraphy, Environmental Science, and the Parapsychology Revolution. Dr. Robert Schock, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be on.
Now, I know that in this book you talk a lot about our assumptions of how old advanced civilizations are and how those many of those assumptions of mainstream science over the years are wrong, in your view, in the evidence that you found. Maybe a good starting point, maybe for those of us who have forgotten, you know, some of our schooling, kind of give us the mainstream view of how old ancient civilizations are and go back, and then maybe contrast it with your view and what you found.
Okay. The classical standard view, and this is what most of your listeners probably learned in school at some point if they studied such things or were exposed to it, and certainly what I got when I was an undergraduate and graduate student at Yale University where I did my graduate work, is that civilization goes back no more than about 6,000 years at the most, that we can date the earliest civilizations, that is the earliest sort of sophisticated technologies and thinking and monument building, to the period of about 4,000 to 3,000 BC. And you first get civilization in middle Mesopotamia and Egypt, and also very shortly thereafter in what is now Pakistan or Pakistan-Indian border you get in China. But basically, it only goes back to 6,000 years at the most, 5 to 6,000 years ago. And before that, you simply have, you know, essentially what anthropologists classically called hunters and gatherers, foragers, people who are eking out a living, Stone Age people, New Stone Age, admittedly, as they call it, but very simple technologies, very unsophisticated in their thinking, and essentially scrounging a living, you know, as best they can, really had no time or energy to do anything else. They tended to be nomadic. They were traveling, so they weren't building large structures. And everything just changed and blossomed with the beginning of Sumeria, that region, the beginning of Egypt, as I said, a little over 5,000 years ago. So that's the classical point of view. What we're finding, and what I've advocated now for over 20 years, really going back to 1990 when I first started talking about this publicly, is that civilization, sophisticated culture, true civilization, goes back thousands and thousands of years earlier. And to make a very long story short, my own history with this is I first went to Egypt as a geologist some years after I received my degree in geology and geophysics, my PhD from Yale, and I went there with a man named John Anthony West, whom some people may have heard of or know his work, and I was invited to look at the Great Sphinx specifically from a geological perspective. And what I concluded was that the core body, the oldest portion of the Great Sphinx, has to go back well before dynastic time, so well before 3000 BC. It was eroded by water, by precipitation, by essentially huge rains. It sits on the edge of the Sahara Desert now. We know the Sahara Desert has been a hyper-arid desert for at least 5,000-plus years, so there was a huge disconnect between what the geology said to me and what the archaeologists and historians were saying about civilization and when civilization began. And this essentially created a huge ruckus. People wanted to figuratively burn me at the stake, certain academics. But what I've done is I've persisted. I've been pursuing this ever since. So, like I said, over 20 years now, going on 25 years, really. And we have more and more evidence now that, in fact, there is true civilization going back thousands of years earlier. And to make a long, very long story short, and we can talk about the more, we can talk about it in more detail as I do in Forgotten Civilization, but I believe we have good evidence of true civilization before the end of the last ice age, circa 9700 BC. So that's almost 12,000 years ago, and that civilization declined, it collapsed, and went into a dark age, if you would. And what we see 5 to 6,000 years ago is simply a reemergence of civilization.
Interesting. Now, let me ask you this. Now, I thought that the part of the aim of academia and science and so forth was the idea that we're always searching to perfect our knowledge or improve our knowledge. You can never perfect it. So if a young researcher has some compelling evidence about something that is breaking the paradigm, one would think in the ideal sense that that would be welcomed with open arms. Why such a visceral reaction to what you postulated? Why not say, let's take a look at what this man has here?
Well, there's two issues there. One is the ideal sense, but human beings, real people, tend not to be ideal in my experience. I expected ideal sense naively, very, very naively, and there were actually two reactions to my initial work. One was the reaction of geologists and geophysicists. I first presented my data on the Great Sphinx at the Geological Society of America annual meeting. It's a huge meeting. Geologists actually come internationally to go to the meeting, even though it's Geological Society of America. There are literally thousands of people at these meetings. I presented to a packed crowd. Virtually all the geologists agreed with me. And they said, yeah, this is very interesting, blah, blah, blah. But the thing is, they had no particular vested interest in the origin of civilization. They had no vested interest in Egypt or when Egypt may have begun. Almost immediately after my presentation, there were some reporters there. They got on the phone. Back in those days, it was phone. They got on the phone and called Egyptologists around the country and told the Egyptologists, relayed to the Egyptologists, what I was suggesting, that the Sphinx goes back much earlier, et cetera, et cetera. Egyptologists would respond with their pat answers, not even having seen my data, not having been at my presentation, and they would say, that's impossible, that's ridiculous, we've had, I forget what exactly how the quotes went, some of them were, we've had thousands of Egyptologists studying this for hundreds of years. We know how old the Sphinx is. There's no question about it. The pyramids were not built by aliens from outer space. They would literally said things like that. And, of course, I never talked about aliens from outer space, and I wasn't talking about the pyramids. But people have vested interests, and academia is no different than any other field. If your life work seems threatened by a outsider or even an insider trying to discredit them or overthrow what they're doing, they take it very personally, and they're very vicious, very vindictive. Academia can be one of the most vindictive fields, I would say. And I'm talking as an academic. To this day, I'm an academic. I teach at Boston University. But the truth is, that's how people act.
Yeah, I think people are people. They can be in different environments, but human nature is human nature. And it even extends to the halls of learning we have learned.
Absolutely. So you have this ideal, but you have the reality, and it ties in with things like the peer review system. And I actually talk about this in forgotten civilization, both in the text, and I have an appendix that I talk about these types of issues. For instance, you have the peer review system, which on the face of it seems like it should be wonderful because, yes, there's a bunch of nonsense out there, people, you know, coming up with false data or just sort of imagining things. I'm not talking about anyone specifically now. I mean, even within academia, you have frauds. You have people who falsify data to promote their own careers, and you need a system to try to weed that out. On the other hand, the system also weeds out anyone who is questioning the standard paradigm, and consistently things do not make it into academic journals or make it into the mainstream if it questions the standard paradigm. It's very tough to go against the fundamental ways people think. And I hate to compare myself. I'm not comparing myself to some of the greats of history, but look at what happened to people like Galileo or Copernicus, you know, the whole business of does the Earth go around the sun or does the sun go around the Earth?
Absolutely.
In those cases, there was very clear experimental evidence on the part, you know, that Copernicus and Galileo could point to. So, you know, it wasn't just one hypothesis over the other. There was clear data supporting one.
And I think that mainstream science at any given time, there are certain people within it who feel that they have all the answers and there's no new information. You know, years ago in a different discipline, but scientists believe in the ether, and that's one side of the coin. The other side of the coin is nobody knew anything about something like DNA, for example, but that didn't mean it did not exist. It was just we weren't caught up to it in terms of our knowledge and technology to figure it out. So I always like the idea of an open mind. I love science, but sometimes it almost becomes to the sense a particular theory becomes almost a dogma and a religion.
Oh,
and
absolutely. I think that the extremes of science are, I should not say science, the practitioners of science, it becomes a dogma, it becomes a religion. And there's this very fine line of being open-minded and skeptical, if I could use that term. And I mean skepticism, genuine skepticism. I consider myself a genuine skeptic versus the skeptics with a capital S, the debunkers who are just there to defend the standard paradigm. I think we need to look at everything with an open mind.
Now, I do want to, and I just want to touch on this briefly before we go on and talk about these ancient civilizations that stretch far back, much further than we had thought previously. However, I want to make this clear. You're not, I know you've appeared on Ancient Aliens and people associate you with that program, but I don't think it's fair to say that you're necessarily a believer in the idea of ancient aliens, are you?
No, I'm not at all. Yes, I've appeared on Ancient Aliens. Why, you might ask? Because I was badgered into it. I shouldn't say it that way. The Prometheus people who put together, they actually interview quite a number of different people from different realms. And to me, Ancient Aliens is not so much a show about ancient aliens, but a show about questions that we have in the standard paradigm. Really to get people thinking. And I think it does a lot of good as far as hopefully getting people to think about the standard worldview, the standard paradigm, and looking at alternatives. So that's why I've agreed to be on it more than a few times. They've interviewed me several times for the show, and then they use snippets here and there. But am I an advocate of ancient alien intervention in human civilization? No. Do I think there's probably ancient aliens? No, I shouldn't say ancient aliens. Do I think there's probably alien life out there in the universe somewhere? I can't imagine that it wouldn't be the case. The probability is so high for life elsewhere on our planet, elsewhere in the solar system, potentially, certainly elsewhere in the galaxy and universe. Could some of them be advanced civilizations? I don't see why not. There's lots of scientific evidence, certainly, for life outside of Earth. But again, this is a very different question than, you know, the thesis of ancient aliens coming and tampering with civilization, tampering with life. And I just don't know. But I, on the other hand, I want to be open. And if we found direct, good, solid evidence for it, I don't want to be in a situation where I would simply dismiss it out of hand as impossible, as some of my academic colleagues 20-some years ago dismissed my evidence out of hand as impossible. Yet I feel that I'm being vindicated now with maybe some of the sites we'll talk about in a few minutes.
An enlightened point of view. Dr. Robert Schock is our guest. The show is The Paranormal Podcast, and we will be back right after this message. Well, it's the holiday season, and I wanted to tell you about a couple of cool things that get me in the holiday mood. One of them is my book, Jim Harold's Campfire, True Ghost Stories. Actually, it's True Ghost Stories, Jim Harold's Campfire 2. And we were so pleased to be a number one bestseller in the Kindle store under the supernatural category during the Halloween season. And we think it makes a great holiday gift. Whether you're talking about the Kindle edition for $2.99, the paperback edition for under $9, or if you buy the paperback from Amazon, you can get the Kindle for only 99 cents as part of their great matchbook program. So we think it's a great thing. If you love spooky stories, and there's spooky stories galore in this book, 70 of them, runs about 254 pages, you may just want to pick it up. And the way that you do that is go over to jimharold.com and check it out and see what you think. I think that you'll like it. You click on the link there, it'll take you over to Amazon. And I think we have about 107 reviews as of this reading, and 5 stars. So I guess the proof is in the pudding. Folks seem to like it, and I hope that you'll like it too. Also, I wanted to tell you, and this is kind of more for longtime listeners. Usually when somebody's new, I always encourage that if they're interested in what we do, if you hear this show tonight, it's your first time, go over to jimharold.com, because over there we have 90 days of free shows, the Paranormal Podcast, this show, and then Jim Harold's Campfire, which is my other podcast, my other free podcast, that is dedicated to those kind of spooky stories that we just talked about, caller experiences, those kind of things. If you're new, go check those out. Don't worry about this message. This message here is more for longtime listeners. If you're a longtime listener and you love the Paranormal Podcast and the Campfire, you can subscribe to my Plus Club over at jimharold.net. And over there, what you can do is you can sign up. We've got a great sale going on right now through the end of November, and you can get access to over 700 podcasts. You can get access to webinars that we've done with people like Peter Robbins and Michelle Belanger and Carol Oblie. And those are like video courses, basically, like you'd see at a conference. But you get all that back catalog of all the paranormal podcasts since 2005, all the campfires since 2009, and all the exclusive shows that have never been on the free feed. I invite you to check it out at jimharold.net. And now I just have one more thing that our announcer is going to tell you about, and I appreciate you tuning in, and I hope that you're enjoying this paranormal podcast. And here's that special message.
Jim's upgrading his computer for 2014 to keep the shows going strong. This holiday season, please do your shopping via Jim's Amazon.com links at jimharold.com. You'll get the same great price and selection, while Jim will receive a small commission to assist with his equipment upgrades. Happy holidays.
Our guest is Dr. Robert M. Schock, Ph.D. He is the author of numerous books, including his most recent, Forgotten Civilization, The Role of Solar Outbursts in Our Past and Future. And Dr. Schock, the ancient civilizations that you speak of that stretch back or back further, much further than the mainstream view. Can you tell us a little bit about those civilizations, the technology that they had, the capabilities that they had, from what you can determine? What do you think they were like?
It is very hard to know exactly what they were like, because we have very little other than some material remains from them. Let me describe some of the material remains we have. I first became aware, or I first came to the hypothesis, should we say, that there was some truth to very ancient civilizations based on my work on the Great Sphinx that we discussed before the break. And the Great Sphinx is potentially the grandest monument on Earth. To this day, it's carved out of the bedrock, And when it was carved out of the bedrock, they had to carve down below the level of the head. And I want to make the comment that the head is a recarving. It is an Egyptian dynastic head. It was recarved. But when they carved the bedrock to free up the body of the Sphinx, they didn't just chip away at the rock and sort of break it up and with picks and hoes and shovel it out. They actually carved out huge limestone blocks weighing tens of tons, and they erected them in front of the current Sphinx in what is known as the Sphinx Temple. So this is this huge megalithic structure that goes back as far as the core body, the oldest portions of the Sphinx. At this point, I hypothesize it goes back to the end of the last ice age based on lots of different lines of data. So my point is, when you ask what kind of people these were incredibly sophisticated at some technological level to be able to carve out these huge blocks and then use them to build a temple or a structure. We don't really know what the function of the structure was, but we tend to call it a temple because we don't know otherwise. But this is not some kind of simple feat to do, to either carve them technically, to move them technically, or to put them in position, because you're talking a very small area. So even if you hypothesize, oh, they were using hundreds and hundreds of people to do it, well, where would you put all these hundreds of people to move the blocks around in a very confined space? And the anthropologist told me 20-some years ago they weren't sophisticated enough societally. They didn't have, you know, they couldn't even get three people or five people to organize and cooperate, much less hundreds of people to do this. So, but the evidence says otherwise. So they seem to have had some kind of sophisticated, not just technologies, but social structures, must have had some kind of hierarchy, some kind of leadership, some kind of planning. The other site I want to mention, which represents them, is Göbekli Tepe in southeastern Turkey. This is a very, very important site. It is well dated by radiocarbon dating to the period of 9 to 10,000 BC, so the same period I've been talking about for many years earlier, for many years based on my work on the Sphinx. This site is being excavated by Klaus Schmidt of the German Archaeological Institute, so impeccable credentials. He's been working there. He did not discover the site, or I should say rediscover the site, until after I had already been working on the Sphinx and announced my research and discoveries, and anthropologists, archaeologists said, well, where's another site? And I couldn't say where's another site definitively because he hadn't even discovered the site yet. He's now excavating it. I've spoken with him. I've visited it numerous times. And this is a site to describe it. And getting back to your question, think of Stonehenge. People should think of Stonehenge because it consists of essentially circles or enclosures, they're called, of huge megalithic stones that have been erected and set upright. Most of them are about 10 to 12 stones in a circle, and then there are central pillars in the middle. So it sort of gives the impression of Stonehenge, but there's not just one of these enclosures. There are dozens of them to be excavated. He has excavated approximately the better portion of four so far, I should say. He's starting to excavate some others, but there are dozens there. They date back to 9 to 10,000 BC. They're also unlike Stonehenge, because Stonehenge is very crudely rough-hewn to almost natural stone blocks, very rough, very crude. Göbekli Tepe, they are beautifully finished limestone blocks. They stand, in some cases, up to 5 meters or more tall. They are carved with animals on them. Some of them are humanoid. They have arms on them. They have hands. They have belts. They have loincloths. They have symbols on them. I believe what the more I look at it, and the more I study it, I think these could be absolute symbolic notation. Klaus Schmidt, who's a very conservative, in some ways, archaeologist, but very cutting edge also, has come to the same conclusion. So there may be a consistent symbolism on the pillars, some shapes that look sort of like H's, other shapes that look like an H on its side, some look like C's, backwards C's. You know, I'm using
right.
letters of the alphabet as analogy. Now, if these are symbols and they have a particular meaning and context, think about what if people were excavating New York City 12,000 years from now and only a few remains were left, including maybe a sculpted, you know, sign for some building, that type of thing. All they might see is a few letters, and they might say, well, that's just symbols that are meant to be pretty decoration. They wouldn't necessarily
right.
extrapolate from it that we had a written language. I'm suggesting that there's the distinct possibility these people had written language, genuine written language on top of everything else, on top of the technology. So, you know, everything I look at, the more we find, the more sophisticated they seem. I'll give you one other example. A bracelet made out of obsidian, volcanic rock, was found that dates from this period, this very early period. It is so beautifully carved and polished that it has absolutely stunned physicists, not archaeologists, but physicists who have studied it and have said this is so perfectly ground. It's, you know, comparable to the best optics work that we can now do with modern machinery. So
amazing.
There is something amazing going on there, and we're just scratching the tip of the proverbial iceberg. But I have no doubt that we're talking on many levels, very, very sophisticated civilization at this very early period of time.
Now, back to Bekele Tepe. Now, I had heard you say at one point that that site was actually, for some reason, apparently intentionally obscured. Can you talk about that? Because I find that fascinating.
Yes, Bekele Tepe was intentionally buried. And there's no doubt about this. I've looked at the stratigraphy as a geologist. I've talked to Schmidt, Klaus Schmidt, about this. What you have at Göbekli Tepe, I am absolutely convinced, is a site that spans the end of the last ice age. So just to put that in context for people that don't know exactly what I'm talking about. Geologically, you have the ice age. You have a very cold period. That's why it's called the ice age. You have glaciers that were came down to lower latitudes. Where Göbekli Tepe is, you did not have glaciers, but it was a different climate. That ends about 9700 BC, catastrophically from a geological and human point of view. All of a sudden, the temperatures got very warm. Incredible increases within just a couple of years, maybe within weeks or even days. To make a long story short, the subtitle of my book, Forgotten Civilization, is The Role of Solar Outbursts in Our Past and Future. And I believe all the evidence indicates that there was a major solar outburst at the end of the last ice age, which caused incredible devastation on the surface of the Earth, would have affected the Göbekli Tepe people. And I believe we see evidence of this at Göbekli Tepe. Pillars were knocked down. It's very clear that they were knocked down before the site was intentionally buried in 8,000 BC. They were hastily re-erected in some cases. Walls were built between the pillars. These are secondary walls. So to me, there's all the signs of confusion. You know, something's happening at this site. They are trying to re-erect pillars. There's evidence that they reused some of the pillars, recarved some of the pillars in haste. You see a definite decline in the artistic level of achievement, should we say, from the oldest portions of the site to the younger portions, which are just after the technical end of the last ice age. And then by 8,000 BC, and we base this on good radiocarbon dates, the entire site was covered over intentionally. Purposefully, they trucked in tons and tons and tons of debris and filled it in layer by layer to bury it over. Now, why were they trying to protect it? Did they think they could come back and re-excavate it when, you know, things calmed down environmentally, when the sun had, you know, sort of stabilized again and environment was much better? Did they intend it for posterity? We just don't know, but it was intentionally covered over. Very different than the typical archaeological site, which is simply, you know, abandoned and left to the wind, left to the rain, and slowly covered over by nature.
Now, very advanced civilizations, catastrophic event occurs. Civilizations reestablish themselves, albeit at a lower level, and they build back up.
Right.
Can you talk to us about the cataclysmic event, specifically how it relates to solar outbursts and how quick it took place? Because I found that, how quickly it took place, because I found that to be quite fascinating, the possibility that this all may have literally happened overnight.
It could have literally happened overnight, at least the first salvo, should we say. The evidence based on ice cores, based on sediment cores, based on isotope data in these various types of cores, based on now what we're finding, little bits of charred glass, essentially naturally formed glass known as vitrification at that time period, is all that evidence indicates to me that there was a major solar outburst at that time. We know from isotope data that can track solar activity. There was incredible solar activity at the end of the last ice age, and there seems to have been a major solar outburst. And when I say major solar outburst, think of solar flares. People may be familiar with that, what's known as coronal mass ejections, when material is literally thrown off the surface of the sun and comes as a ball of what's technically known as plasma. It's very fast-moving. People can think of it as a gas. It's not technically a gas, but charged particles. It hits the Earth if the Earth gets in the way. You know, sometimes they go off into a different direction in space, but apparently one hit the Earth. It interacts with the geomagnetic field of the Earth. It causes electricity to come down to the Earth. You can think of huge lightning bolts. They're not technically lightning bolts. They're much more powerful, essentially hitting parts of the Earth. This could set fires. It would certainly warm up the climate. If it hits where glaciers are, it would melt the ice, it would melt water in different areas, so cause incredible changes on the surface of the Earth. It would include a lot of rain, because as you change the temperature conditions, as you literally melt glaciers very catastrophically, you would put a lot of moisture into the atmosphere. It has to precipitate out again. This, I believe, at this point, ties in with the rains that eroded the Sphinx, for instance, ties in, I believe, with the worldwide stories of floods that you have literally around the world. It would cause earthquakes, because we know even now with modern global warming in Iceland, for instance, when you melt glaciers relatively quickly, and it's only relatively quickly in Iceland, you have increased earthquake activity, increased volcanic activity, because it's essentially releasing pressure. Because we're talking glaciers that were miles and miles thick. Based on the isotope data, however, all of this happened within at least 3 years. And based on the resolution of the isotope data, it may have literally happened within weeks or days, the initial salvo. And probably what happened, again, looking at longer-term isotope data, is you'd have these major solar outbursts, a really big one at the end of the last ice age. Then the sun would sort of calm down a little bit. Then you would have another one, calm down a little bit, another one. So just as these people were being hit by one, it would have been a horrible disaster. Then it would seem like things calmed down a little bit. They might try to regroup themselves, and then they're hit by another one.
Amazing.
It's a very, very bad situation. And this went on for some centuries or even millennia, probably about 2,000 years, you know, calming down. Then the sun went through, I don't want to call it a dormant period, but a period which was when it was much more stable for thousands of years. There, I think we had a dark age, if you would, but civilization slowly regrouped, reemerged about 3500 BC, and you know, we sort of know the story from then with Egypt and, you know, rising up to where we are now. But to come to the end of the story, what we see now is a lot of variability in the sun, a lot of activity going up and down. We've had some major peaks. Now people in the last few months have been talking about this sun becoming dormant, but this is exactly what we see at the end of the last ice age, that it has
right.
these incredible peaks, then it goes into a trough, it goes very quiet, but the next thing you know, it can peak again. So it's basically becoming very unstable once again, just like it was at the end of the last ice age.
So, I mean, is this kind of a warning shot against our bow that we should look back to the past to prepare for the future? Oh.
I have absolutely no doubt that's one of the messages of forgotten civilization. And I'll give you another example, which some people are familiar with, some are not. In 1859, there was the Carrington event. The Carrington event was a major solar outburst. From a human perspective, it was the biggest one we've seen in modern history. And when I say modern history, I'm talking the last 500 or 1,000 years. It was known as the Carrington event. It was a major solar flare and coronal mass ejection. It hit the Earth. People saw all kinds of weird things in the sky. You know, think of northern lights, but hundreds of times more powerful, thousands mm-hmm. of times more powerful. It caused disturbances in the electromagnetic field of the Earth. It overpowered the telegraph lines of the time. This is 1859, so the only electronics were really telegraph lines. It overpowered those, burnt out telegraph stations, you know, didn't cause that much damage to civilization as a whole because it's 1859. Carrington event, if we had one tomorrow, it would just wipe out, you know, grid systems and satellite communication. It would wipe out, we would not be talking on the phone here.
Right. And
1859, Carrington event, that's not very long ago geologically. I think that is the immediate, what do they call it, shot across the bow, saying, look, we better pay attention to things. The big one is coming. The Carrington event was not the big one. That's just sort of like a little tremor ahead of time.
And it's amazing to me that electronics and so forth aren't hardened, because you think of something like electromagnetic pulse that could be
yes.
used by terrorists and things like that. So,
exactly.
so, but, you know, then everybody's crying, well, what happened? Why didn't we think of this? Despite
exactly.
Voices in the wilderness saying, you know, better prepare for this. Now, one thing I want to go back to real quick, because it does remind me of this, is the idea of a great civilization and all of a sudden suddenly being wiped out. Reminds me a lot of Atlantis.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And I'm glad you brought that up. Atlantis, to me, is absolutely fascinating. I've had, in my personal relationship with Atlantis has been very over the years, should we say. I read Plato as a kid. I mean, I just enjoyed reading Plato and reading about Atlantis. I thought it was fascinating, as many people do. I went to college and graduate school, and, oh, you know, of course, Atlantis is just total nonsense from a scientific point of view, at least when I was in college and graduate school. When I first got involved with my research on ancient civilizations back in the late 80s, early 90s, I would not say the word Atlantis publicly because there was so much baggage, should we say. Anyone that talked about Atlantis from an academic point of view, they were just dismissed. You know, they're that just proves they're loony and we don't take anything they say seriously. But now I'm talking about Atlantis. Why? Because when you start looking at the Atlantis story as recounted by Plato, what to me is important at this point, and more than coincidence, I just do not think it's simple coincidence. What is important to me is the dating. When you take Atlantis, the story, and you look at Plato and you take him at his word, he talks about it, translated into modern calendar, the calendar we use, basically as being about 9600 BC. End of the last ice age, based on the best data now, and this is within just the last couple of years, 9700 BC. I think that is amazing coordination of dates. And I don't think it's just, you know, just willy-nilly that Plato happened to be talking about the end of the last ice age from a modern perspective, the dating. I think that the Atlantis story, in my opinion now, goes back to the recollections of a mighty civilization, a sophisticated civilization at the end of the last ice age. Now, as far as the placement geographically of Atlantis, that type of thing, I'm not adamant. In fact, I think that, you know, he may have placed Atlantis wherever he did, and people argue about even his description where exactly it would be. I think the geographic position is not as important as the temporal position that he puts it in, if I could say it that way.
I know our time is growing short, and I certainly want to give you time to talk a little bit about your website. I know you have an exciting event coming up next year that you'd like to tell folks about and so forth. I do want to ask you one question, though, because some in this book towards the end, and also you've done a book on parapsychology, people wonder about how ancient civilizations like the Egyptian civilization tie into the mystical, the paranormal. And since this is a paranormal podcast, we probably should tip our hat to it at least.
Yeah.
Give us a brief overview on your thoughts on that. And I know I'm asking you to kind of encapsulate a huge subject in a couple minutes, but your thoughts.
Well, I do talk about these things in Forgotten Civilization, especially the last chapter when I talk about ancient wisdom and new science. And I think a lot of our cutting-edge science, which is outside of the box of the standard paradigm, is, in fact, supporting what we'll call paranormal phenomena. And when I say paranormal, I tend to use it, and I'm using it right now, in a more restricted sense than some people might. So I'm not talking about UFOs, that type of thing. In fact, I'm not convinced that UFOs, whether they exist or not, are necessarily paranormal. What I'm talking about is more, I'll call it technical or a restricted sense of paranormal, the subject of parapsychology, things like telepathic communication or telepathic transmission of thoughts, or information is really a better way to put it, or people being affected by things like electromagnetic radiation, electromagnetic background. So, for instance, I'll give you one, for instance, that ties in with solar activity and ancient thoughts. Most ancient cultures, in fact, virtually all that I've studied in detail, have a fairly consistent theme when it comes to deep history, large, extended ancient history, should we say. Ancient civilizations, the Greeks, the Romans, the Egyptians, so the modern, if I could put it that way, ancient civilizations all agreed that there were previous very ancient civilizations. They would often express this in things like the precessional year, going through different ages, Pisces, Aquarius, that type of thing. They would talk about the Golden Age, the Silver Age, the Bronze Age, the Iron Age. They would talk about the Yuga cycle if you're talking about the Hindu civilizations. And most scientists, you know, most academics, they just dismiss this as absolute nonsense. I think there may be something to it. In fact, I do think there's something to it when we start looking at the cycles of the sun, the cycles of the cosmos. And I think there's also something to it in the sense that our environment, our subtle environment, and here I'm really focusing at the moment, but not necessarily exclusively, on the electromagnetic environment that we are bathed by, affects our psyche, affects our, I believe, mental abilities. There are very strong correlations between telepathic experiences and the geomagnetic flux, which I find incredibly interesting. I believe personally that once you get rid of all the charlatans and nonsense, that type of thing, there is something to telepathy. There is genuine information transfer in, I'll call it the real cases of it, that correlates with the geomagnetic flux. It's also been demonstrated that correlates with sidereal time, more or less our relationships to the stars or the cosmos in a greater extent. So there are very interesting things going on here. There are correlations between radioactive decay rates and our distance from the sun, which should not be the case by conventional scientific thinking, yet repeated studies by very competent physicists have demonstrated this is the case. So there's a lot of interesting things going on that are not generally acknowledged by status quo science, which I think we need to really look at and consider. And the reason I got into the paranormal and the parapsychology originally was you can't ignore it if you're honest to the ancients, because they consistently talk about phenomena using their own terminology, but that we would interpret or we would label now as paranormal or parapsychological or psychic. So studying the Great Pyramid, I wrote a book on the Great Pyramid. What was the function of the Great Pyramid? If you listen to the ancients themselves, in part it was to alter consciousness, to go into different realms of psychical awareness, if you would, to enhance what we might call telepathic experiences. So were they building this incredible structure at great time and expense and effort just for something that was a pipe dream that doesn't even exist? I had to answer that for myself, and I came to the conclusion, well, yes, it really does exist, and there is something going on there.
Well, it's a fascinating path of discussion, and we could talk about it all day, but I know that time is growing short here, so I want to give you every opportunity, Dr. Schock. It's been a pleasure to talk to you today, to tell people about, to talk about some of the things you have coming up, because I think they'll be of interest.
Yeah, well, I continue my research on all fronts, all of these things, but most immediately, and this may be what you're alluding to, Robert Bovall, who is a colleague and friend of mine. People may know him from the Orion Mystery. He and I have collaborated just recently. We've collaborated to put together a trip with a friend of ours who is out of Poland, Gregory Poblowski. And Robert Bovall and I are doing a trip in July of 2014, which we're very excited about, where we will be traveling through Turkey to look at various ancient sites, including very ancient sites from what I'll call the Dark Ages, from 6,000, 7,000 BC. But most importantly, we will be going to Göbekli Tepe. It'll be, I've been there numerous times, but I love going back every single time. I don't think Robert Bovall has actually seen Göbekli Tepe before, because he spent most of his time in Egypt. So it will be very exciting for me to be able to show it to him. And people are invited to join us on this tour. It's going to be an incredible tour. And, we'll have the chance to talk and discuss as we see numerous sites. Then we will be going to Petra after that. And we're doing it such that if people just want to go to Turkey with us, that's fine. If they just want to do Petra with us, that's fine. Or if they would like to join us for the entire tour, that is possible too.
And Petra,
of course, is an incredible site. And if people haven't seen it, they have to see it. So Göbekli Tepe, Petra, but it'll be so much more. And people can find out about this by going to my website, www.robertschock.com. And my last name is spelled S-C-H-O-C-H, so robertschock.com. And I have a link to the full itinerary.
And also, I'm assuming folks can pick up Forgotten Civilization at the various online sites like Amazon and everywhere. Fine books are sold.
Absolutely, yeah. Amazon probably has the best price at the moment. I know I buy a lot of books on Amazon, but Amazon or wherever good books are sold.
Well, Dr. Robert M. Schock, the book is Forgotten Civilization, The Role of Solar Outbursts in Our Past and Future. Dr. Schock, thank you for joining us today on the Paranormal Podcast.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
Well, everybody, I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. Had a great time with Dr. Schock. He's a very erudite, knowledgeable guy, and really, really enjoyed the time we got to spend together. And I've enjoyed the time we've gotten to spend with you. To my longtime listeners, thank you so much. One thing that I forgot to mention earlier, everybody can get in on this if you're in the continental United States. I am having a big holiday book giveaway. I'm going to be giving away a 10-pack of books and a 2 5-packs of books, of paranormal books, and we're going to have a random drawing on December 6th, and we'll be sending those out for the holiday season. Now, you may ask, Jim, how can I get in on this giveaway goodness? Well, the answer is simple. Go over to jimherold.com. Over there, you will see a link to enter this contest. You click on that link, and then what you do is you sign up for my weekly newsletter, and once you're on that list, you are set to also be in the drawing. So if you're already on the list, don't worry about this. You are automatically entered if you're in the continental U.S. And if you're not, I suggest run, don't walk, and go over to jimherold.com and sign up for that. And if you're new, you'll not only see that contest, you'll see 90 days of free content. The Paranormal Podcast, the show you just heard, and Jim Harold's Campfire, True Stories of the Supernatural. I hope that you enjoyed the program, listeners old and new, and we'll talk to you next week on the Paranormal Podcast. Bye-bye, everybody.
Now for the legal disclaimer. We do not accept money from publishers or content producers in exchange for interviews. However, as with most media outlets, in the majority of cases, we do receive complimentary copies of books and DVDs that we feature on our podcasts. Your purchases of books, DVDs, and other items via our Amazon.com links benefit Jim Harold and JimHarold.com and help us continue our programming. The sponsor messages you hear on the programs are paid endorsements, although we really do like them. For the full disclaimer, go to jimherold.com, and thanks for listening.